House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 23rd, 2009. The first item on the agenda is House Bill 2425. Modifies elements of felony driving while in the influence of intoxicants to include prior participation in diversion programs.
Mr. Chair, you stole my line.
Okay. That's all you're going to say? Okay. We'll have the first hearing on this. It came back with a fiscal, so we're not going to work today, but we're going to take a look at some amendments. Ms. Pratt and Mr. Harkleroad, please.
For the record, my name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee this afternoon. The Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI fully supports House Bill 2425 because of the repeat high-risk DUI offenders, such as the following case in Multnomah County. Just one example of how current law has had a huge negative effect on several lives. This particular offender had three prior DUIs within 10 years and also had a fourth pending misdemeanor DUI at the time. We also know that under Oregon law, he would have been entitled to diversion prior to the three DUIs. This offender was on his way to his fourth DUI trial in Clackamas County during the morning commute. Cars at 40 miles an hour with no evidence that he even tried to stop. The victims included a mother and her teenage daughter on their way to her daughter's school. They both sustained neck and back injuries. Another victim in another car was on his way to work. He sustained severe whiplash and other injuries. All the victims were incapacitated for some time, and their vehicles were horribly wrecked. The offender could hardly stand up, much less drive. A search warrant was issued to obtain blood, and soon after he consented to a urine draw, which showed multiple illegal drugs in his system. At the time of the crash, not only was the offender on his way to a trial, he was also currently on probation for two misdemeanor DUIs in Multnomah County. He was charged with felony DUI, assault 3x2, reckless driving, reckless endangering 2x, misdemeanor driving while suspended, criminal mischief 2x2. If House Bill 2425 were already law, we could have counted the diversion on his third DUI. Convicting him of felony DUI, possibly this offender would have been incarcerated and this crash wouldn't have happened. There would not be victims, their pain, their suffering, the trauma, and the economic loss, which the National Highway Safety Administration calculates at an average of $108,000 per DUI injury. We need House Bill 2425 to keep our families safe. Please forward House Bill 2425. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Pratt? Thank you. Mr. Harkleroad.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name's Doug Harkleroad. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. And for this particular bill, and several others today, I also represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Both the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and the Oregon District Attorneys Association support House Bill 2425. Let me pause there and say that we believe in diversion. We believe in diversion. But it shouldn't take five times being under the influence of intoxicants driving on the highway before it becomes a felony. This, in essence, bill says four times. And so we're supportive of that. I shan't talk further unless there are questions.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any questions? Thank you very much. Lee Berger.
Are we letting them have 4 or 10 years?
Chair Parker, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 83020, which means I've been practicing for more than 25 years. My wife says it means I'm older than dirt. I've practiced law statewide, although I live in Representative Shields County and Senator Carter's County. I've had cases with Ms. Savelle when she was in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I practice statewide representing medical cannabis patients and their providers, and I do appeals. I do occasionally handle driving under the influence law. I'm here today, the hat I'm here today wearing is on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, which opposes the bill. The reason why there isn't a lawyer who regularly practices doing DUI work here is that at least the ones I talk to view this law and some of the other laws as a stimulus package for them, and they're sort of would be grateful to have you pass this forward. If a first diversion really isn't a diversion, for example, because in driving under the influence as opposed to other crimes, the legislature has decreed that there can be no charge negotiation. And increasingly, including in some of these bills, there's no sentence negotiation either because the sentences are controlled by various mandatory provisions relating to time in jail and to fines. So, principally, the objection to this bill is that it makes diversion not diversion. It makes diversion sort of diversion light. It's diversion so long as there isn't anything else later. And that's not what diversion means, and that's not what the purpose of having diversion in the DUI statute, separate and apart from the district attorney's diversion, which is in the criminal code, applies to other statutes. I haven't seen the fiscal, but our thinking is that this will increase the add to the increase of the unfunded mandate of of both ballot measure 11 and the more recent ballot measure 57 that the legislature referred to the people by increasing the number of felony DUI offenders. And my heart goes out, and our hearts, defense lawyers generally, go out to people who are victimized by drunk drivers or by anybody else breaking the laws and causing injury or pain or suffering or financial damage. But hearing an anecdotal statement about a guy on his way to a trial in Clackamas County doesn't justify this kind of a change in the law. I think that we're spending about $30,000 a year on inmates currently. It's between $25,000 and $30,000. So to the extent that this increases the number of people that we're sending to prison, that's the kind of fiscal that you're looking at. And for these reasons, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association opposes 2425 and urges the committee to not pass the bill forward. I'd be glad to answer any questions, but that's the statement I have for the committee.
Okay, thank you. Measure 57 and Measure 11 really wouldn't apply to this. I don't know the connection. I mean, I know it could be a felony, but those are the Measure 57's property crimes and Measure 11's violent crime.
Chair Barker, just to respond briefly.
Sure.
Both 57 and Measure 11 mandate prison sentences without providing funding for it. The analogy I was trying to draw is that if a diversion no longer really is a diversion, it's a diversion unless there's a subsequent one, which is what I understand 2425 would do. More people will be tried and convicted of felony DUI. More people who are tried and convicted of felony DUI will be sent to prison. This bill doesn't include any funding for that, just like 11 and 57 didn't include funding either.
Okay. And I would have a question. How many diversions do you think they should get? I mean, what the idea of a diversion is that you get stopped, you get your this, so we give you a break, and then you get some hopefully some treatment or at least some education on the drinking. But then you go out and have another, you keep on drinking and driving. It seems to me that it's time to step that up. And
this would make you a little bit closer to a felony conviction, but hopefully people would get the message and stop.
Well, I would hope so too, but again, I'm the way defense lawyers approach these cases in conversations with their clients is, well, you've been charged with felony, you've been charged with driving under the influence, it's your first offense, have you been through any treatment in the last 10 years, have you had a DUI in the last 10 years, if not, you may be eligible for diversion. Diversion is a good deal in the sense that there won't be a conviction, it'll still have an impact on your insurance rate, but it's you know, if you think you're able to successfully complete it, then you would be able to successfully complete it. If 2425 passes, defense lawyers would also be advising their clients, I need to let you know that ordinarily people have three prior convictions as a basis for the fourth one to be a felony, but for you it doesn't have to be a conviction. For you, this diversion would count as a conviction, even though you're doing the diversion and you're doing all these programs and everything. And I think that's likely to result in more trials. And I think that ultimately it will result in more felony driving under the influence conviction. And I think there is a fiscal that's involved here that, although it benefits lawyers who are doing these kinds of cases more frequently than I, it's not clear to me that it's balanced by the representation to the committee that a guy on his way to trial in Clackamas County was driving drunk. I mean, absent some statistics that there are, you know, I don't know, some number of people for whom the felony DUI is actually their fifth or whatever, it just doesn't seem necessary or required at this time, and that's what I'm...
It would seem to me that your argument would kind of be counter to your argument in that you're saying if we do this, then the attorneys are going to tell their client, you just shorten your, if you take this diversion, you just shorten the chance before your felony. I think that would be an important conversation I wish you'd have anyway, and I think that might help that. And the insurance, they don't get the report unless you're over 0.08. You can take a diversion under 0.08, and that's not... you don't lose your license.
Chair Barker, it shows on your driver's record as DIVR. So
okay.
When the insurance company looks on your record, they see that you had a diversion. People's insurance rates are affected. It's not, and you know, recently, I don't remember, again, I'm not doing this all the time, but a couple of sessions ago, the legislature required people plead guilty before they do this. I mean, you used to be able to go to diversion. If you were unsuccessful at diversion, then you can still have a trial.
Right.
You can't do that anymore anyway. So I just don't see the need for this, and I urge the committee to not pass it forward.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berger, I want to address one of your arguments in control. Pretend for a moment that I was not as concerned about the fiscal implications that more people will end up convicted of felony DUI and thus more it will cost the state more because we'll have to incarcerate more. Representative Shields worry about that in due course, I'm confident. However, I want to address your argument specifically about how this is essentially changing the nature of diversion, and I think you referred to it as making it diversion light. And would it address your concerns? Actually, frankly, this could also be a question for the proponents. It seems like a cleaner way of going about this than rather than adding the language or diversion program, we simply just reduce the number of convictions from 3 to 2. It seems like it would actually, I just think it would make this a better bill and address that concern. Would that address your concern?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton. I hadn't considered that until you just mentioned it. So I guess what I'd like to do is to have the opportunity to consult with my colleagues who more regularly practice in this area and get back to you on that if I could. I don't know if you're planning on voting on this today or just what...
We're not.
Okay, well, I'll ask around and I'll get back to you personally.
Mr. Berger, one of the things about the you brought up here is the fiscal, and that's going to be a primary issue in this bill. We're taking another look at that, but this, and of course, if you did what was suggested, that wouldn't really change the fiscal. I mean, if we make it 2,
right?
Yeah, it'd still be the
Chair
same.
Chair Barker, I understood Representative Barton to say excluding comments about the fiscal because my representative is taking care of that concern.
Well, yeah.
Mr. Chair?
We're all trying to take care of that.
I know you are. Yeah. I didn't mean it like that.
Yeah. Mr.
No,
Berger,
that's what he says.
And I appreciate your following up with me. Also, to the extent you feel comfortable, you or somebody from your association, if they perhaps follow up with the proponents of the bill. I don't know how proponents feel, but it does strike me that it achieves the intent in a more parsimonious and cleaner way.
We're pleased and proud to have Gail Meyer here regularly, and I'm certain she's willing to talk to anybody on the other side of any bill about anything.
So. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Stigler.
I, Mr. Chair, piggybacking on what Mr. Martin, Representative Martin, has indicated, I don't know where the proponents would stand on that, but I'm sure that, you know, you're talking. I guess the point I'd make here is that this is a 10-year period of time that we're talking about, and this is effectively the way this is currently written. I don't want to miscount here. This would be the if you include the diversion, it's basically the third time that the person has been stopped for DUI within a 10-year period of time.
Not stopped, arrested.
And I guess going back to the issue of the diversion to begin with, I got the sense from your testimony that you said the diversion, it makes a diversion not a diversion. And I just want to be real clear about that. The intent of a diversion in a DUI case the very first time around, as I've always been aware of it, is to give somebody a second chance. If you've got a follow-up within a course of 10 years and it's either your fourth, incident, I'm not sure that the second chance has worked. I mean, would you disagree with that?
Sure, Barker, Representative Stigler. I don't know the answer to that question. I think what I meant was that the notion of diversion, whether it's a drug court kind of diversion, mm-hmm. like the STOP program that we have in Multnomah County or any of the drug courts around the state, or the non-DUI diversions, is an act of grace by the executive to say that, you know, this is the first time it's happened, you're an otherwise law-abiding person, this one don't count. But to make it not count, we're going to require you to do this, 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 and this, whatever it is, to make that happen. And for DUI, there are specific things that are required to be done. Subsequently counting that as if it were a prior conviction makes it something other than that kind of an act of grace. That's what I meant when I said it makes it something other than diversion. I hope that answers your question.
Any further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question that might also have been better asked of the proponents, but one nice thing about this process is we are allowed ex parte communications. And in some of mine, I have heard that Oregon's penalties around drunk driving are lower than those of most other states. But I wanted rather just to rely on ex parte communication to get some sort of expert guidance on whether or not that's true. Do you have that sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, again, this is not a focal area of my practice, but within our association, there are lawyers that do, and I'm in communication with them, and I'd be glad to
I can find out.
It if I can. Are you asking specifically about when driving under the influence becomes a felony instead of being a misdemeanor? I mean, that seems to be the intent of this legislation.
Not to go too much back and forth, but we are dealing with several pieces of legislation, and that is one specifically, yes, that I got some communication on, that we give more chances than most other states. But, you know, having a sense of what's reasonable in the onward sweep of history is mildly helpful.
And Chair Barker, Representative Smith, I'd be glad to make inquiry of our members and get back to you on that as well.
Okay, and Mr. Berger, just one, I think there's no further questions, just one final fiscal that we haven't talked about, and that is when Dad doesn't come home because some drunk killed him. Huge cost, not only financially, but also huge emotional cost. And I know that you
are on line with me on that. I mean, I'm not saying anybody feels anything.
I was pleased also when I came in to see my friend Chuck Sparks from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. We have a vehicular homicide case that's pre-indictment right now. I can't talk too much about it, except that except to say that one thing that the police officers and I agree on is that this is a huge tragedy all the way around because the decedent is a friend of the person who left the scene of the accident, a close personal friend. I'd be curious to know what the correlation is between felony DUI arrests and prosecutions and injury accidents or fatalities. I suspect it's much lower than the chair suspects. I think it's more in the nature of a status offense, frankly. It's alcoholic while driving, I think is what it is. And it doesn't necessarily involve bad driving, and it doesn't necessarily involve injury to anybody. I just don't know.
Yeah,
but you could check with, I'm thinking Craig Prinz would know.
You can see the numbers of people, though, that are killed, and you read in, even just by reading the paper, and the drunk driving, the drunk driver, and if you don't have, I mean, even if most alcoholics get home without killing somebody, the fact that there are people dying out there that don't need to be dying is the concern. So
I certainly agree with that, Chair Barker, and I just in terms of how to fix that, I think it's important that the legislature act cautiously and not cast too large a net. That's the only thing I'm encouraging
this
afternoon in all these bills.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barker. Close the public hearing on 2425 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2426.
House Bill 2426 would impose a minimum fine and mandatory jail for a person convicted of DUI with a blood alcohol level of 0.2 or greater. You have before you Dash 1 amendments, and the Dash 1 amendments make the following changes. They eliminate the jail requirement, and they lower the threshold BAC down to 0.15. And if you've read regarding the federal funding under the 410 grant, the Dash 1 amendments would fit into that and would qualify.
Question of counsel, if I may, Mr. Chair. So this, when I read this bill, especially as with the Dash 1 amendments, it struck me as identical to 2237. It has a slightly longer sentence. Are we working this one? What's the status of 2237 versus this one? I'm just confused why we have both bills.
2337 came back with a fiscal and a subsequent referral. This one doesn't have that. We're amending it so that it doesn't have the referral. We're trying to comply with the requests made early on in this session to not be sending things down with fiscals that we just can't pass, that can't be handled this time.
And I would caution on this that while we know what the fiscal and revenue are going to be because we're working now with the Dash 1 amendment, we actually are not ready to move the bill today.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to be a pest. May I ask a follow-up? Why is it that this one, it seemed to me, has longer sentences? Why is it this one does not have a subsequent referral, but the other one does?
Go ahead. You know the answer to that?
My understanding is that the Speaker's office is actually just trying to troubleshoot, and they're reading bills and deciding what needs a subsequent referral and what didn't. It may have been that they didn't read this one at the same time. They made a decision that, basically they just made a decision. They sent it here. In any event, with the Dash 1s now, it would have eliminated the issue that existed actually in the other bill as well that would have cost the fiscal.
I see.
Okay. Mr. Berger, why don't you and Ms. Andrea Meyer come up here? Please go ahead, whoever wants to start first, just identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, although we don't have a Dash 1, so.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
Neither Ms. Meyer nor I have the Dash 1s, but I understood Ms. Seville to say that the Dash 1s reduce the percentage from 0.20 to 0.15 and reduce the fine from $2,000 to $1,500. What's that?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The Dash 1 amendments, actually, they strike the mandatory prison, or mandatory jail, I should say, the jail that's listed in the original.
Then I'll go first.
Okay. And they also reduced the threshold for the BAC to 0.15. However, they leave in effect the enhanced fine. Yes.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. My testimony will be very brief. I just, as a matter of policy, when I can, and it doesn't mean I do miss some bills, want to raise concerns about mandatory minimum sentencing. It's something that ACLU opposes, letting the judge fit and tailor the sentencing and the penalty to the crime. But since you have apparently removed that from this bill, my concerns have been addressed.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Meyer. And sorry you didn't have that to you ahead of time.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Nielenberger again. In OCDLA, we view the fine as a mandatory minimum and are opposed to this bill for that reason. Furthermore, whether it's 0.15 or 0.20, I did, responding to an earlier question from Representative Smith, I think in Washington State, their enhanced DUI bill is 1.5 instead of 2.0. I've heard that coming down. But the concern I'm hearing from OCDLA lawyers about both parts, about the 0.15 and the $2,500, is that every case is different and everybody is different. And so, and everybody is affected differently by alcohol. An alcoholic at a 2.0 or a 1.5 even may drive better than you or I at a 0.8. So there's a concern about finding that limit. And in that respect, except to the extent there are places that have, you know, breathalyzers available, people who are drinking and who become intoxicated and who make the mistake about driving don't know what their blood alcohol is, don't know if it's an 0.8 or a 1.0 or a 1.5 or whatever. So there are those kinds of due process concerns among criminal defense lawyers. And I'm just reading which one this is. I think that's it. I think that everyone is different, and both in terms of their ability to pay, in terms of how egregious it is, just because it's at a certain BAC level doesn't mean that it's that if there was an injury or a fatality or damage or bad driving even. And no one knows when they are, you know, at this higher level. So those are the two concerns we have.
Representative Stigler.
This enhanced fine level, though I'd agree with you it's mandatory, there still has to be a conviction, correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, there does still have to be a conviction.
So all those things that you just talked about are subject to argument or proof for evidence at a trial. So it's only after conviction that this enhanced fine comes into play.
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, yes, except that the judge has no discretion.
I understand that, but you were talking about everybody being different, everybody's, you know, impact of alcohol in their system being different. You still have the ability to argue all of that, and this is post-conviction. And I understand your point about it being a mandatory fine, but it's
Chair
still
Barker,
post-conviction.
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, because it's a mandatory fine, it doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter who my client is. It doesn't matter how my client is affected by alcohol. It doesn't matter that there wasn't any bad driving. It doesn't matter. The district attorney charged it. The jury convicted. The judge's hands are tied. OCDLA and ACLU oppose those kinds of schemes.
Sir, I understand that. But the kinds of things that you were talking about, the impact on driving, that kind of thing, those are whether or not, I mean, if conceivably, if your argument is that because this person has a high tolerance, there wasn't the impact on driving, conceivably that could lead to an acquittal. So the kinds of things you're talking about are the kinds of things you argue in the jury trial or judge trial, if you so choose to go that direction. And I just want to be real clear that you can argue after the fact those same things, but if you've been convicted of the very behavior you're talking about, somebody has determined that the person was under the influence.
Chair Barker, Representative Stegler, a person commits the crime of driving under the influence if they have 0.08 or higher. This bill would say if it's adduced at trial or admitted through plea that it was 0.15 or higher, the judge has no choice but to impose a $2,500 fine. So there isn't an opportunity to litigate at trial that the person's not guilty or shouldn't have to have this fine imposed or whatever. It just happens.
I'll just note, he's pointing at me for illustrative purposes only.
I wasn't pointing at you.
Not as your client.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Well, it's true, somebody might not know their blood alcohol. I feel like I'm getting to sound like an old record when the concern is if you don't know, if you have to ask yourself, am I okay to drive or not? I mean, that's the kind of rule of thumb. And if somebody's a 0.15, they're pretty drunk, at least it's been my experience. I mean, they're not always falling down drunk. I mean, I've seen people falling down drunk at that. But this is to get, again, if the serious driver, the alcoholic, off the road is what the intent is. So thank you very much for your testimony. I especially appreciate you coming here when you're not a DUI expert. I'm sure you're competent to take a case, but to come down here and do battle on behalf of people who aren't here for whatever reason, thank you.
Chair Barker, if I could, just really briefly, what the people who are doing it regularly tell me is that everybody metabolizes alcohol differently, and that while for me a 0.15 might mean I'm really drunk and I should know that I'm really way over an 0.08, for some people, not only does it not affect them that much, but that they're actually, except for their blood alcohol, okay to drive. That's what people are telling me.
I think they're not accurate in that. It's been with my experience. And while you may be able to function pretty well, at the split second you need to have that brake slammed on, you don't get it slammed on because your timing is all delayed. But thank you.
Thank you again, Sherbert.
Mr. Harkerow, please. And Mr. Snyder, you could come up too if you would, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkelrode, and for this bill I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and also the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are supportive of the bill with the -1 amendments, recognizing the fiscal issues there. This is a bill for the really drunk guy or gal. So Widmark is a old-time formula. Some of you are probably familiar with that, and it's certainly an approximation, but if you're about 180 pounds, like I try to be most of the time, it takes 7 drinks fairly rapidly to get you to 0.15. If you're a smaller female at 130 pounds, it takes 4 drinks. What's a drink? A drink is a 12-ounce beer, or it's 1 ounce of 100-proof distilled spirits, or it's 4 to 5 ounces of wine. So you got to drink a lot to hit the 0.15 zone. And an enhancement on the fine, somewhat, which is what this -1 amendment does, seems perfectly reasonable.
The National Highway Traffic
Safety Administration would tell you that 0.05 is enough to have you not at your best out there driving on the highway. And we all know that driving on the highway is a divided attention test. Got to look in the rearview mirror, got to keep the steering wheel going, got to keep your foot on the brake or on the gas. So all those field sobriety tests that we're all familiar with, those are divided attention tests, standardized and validated. So if you talk to a medical examiner, as I did many years ago on my first vehicular crash where an individual died, Dr. McMillan said it's 0.03, Doug. They're affected to a noticeable or a perceptible degree at that point. So this bill makes perfect sense. It's a small step in the right direction, and we're supportive. That's all I have.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We have not taken a position on House Bill 2426. We're neutral, and if I understand the Dash Ones correctly, we're even more neutral. If they take out jail, minimum security facilities, or inpatient rehabilitation, that would not have a fiscal impact.
That's what we're shooting for. Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you.
Chair, can I ask a question of counsel?
Yes.
On this bill before we move on? As I'm looking at the staff measure summary, it just seems like a kind of a second issue has been injected, and maybe it was there from the first time and I just wasn't paying attention. Is that if we don't go to the 0.15, we will be out of compliance with federal funding for transportation dollars?
That's my understanding, yes.
But that wasn't brought up with the first bill, is that right?
Gee, I think you did mention that when we first said that this brings us into compliance.
In the first bill, Mr. Hayes actually referenced that some of the changes they're proposing, that was another day where we were doing a package of kind of DUI-related bills, and he said that several of them were going to bring us into compliance and keep us current with some of the federal funding, but we didn't really expand on what that meant, the fact that it's not new money, it's current money, what we have to do to stay in compliance and receive that. And as you'll see, there are several different things they will be looking at, but the 0.15 enhancement, and I have checked, the fine will qualify as an enhancement. It doesn't have to be the jail necessarily, but that would then qualify as one of the criteria that we can meet in order to keep the funding that we currently have, and I think it's already built into the budget, my understanding.
So could I ask a follow-up? So
yes,
are there other ways to meet that criteria besides going to the 0.15?
I think that I tried to include it kind of, there's a graph kind of bridging the bottom of page 1 into page 2.
Oh, I see.
And I beg my pardon, I read this and was working on this last week, so I'm not as up on it as I was. But what we have currently, I believe, are the ones that are already checked, and they every year they increase the number of things we have. And I believe this year it was going to be moving into 5. Yes, we'd have to qualify for 5 criteria. We have 4. One of the possible 5th criteria would be the creation of further diversion in DUI courts. However, we would have to guarantee that that would be implemented by the end of this fiscal year, I believe. And I don't know the status, because I know that nothing has been implemented yet. They've looked at places, and I think some counties have been interested. So this would bring us into automatic compliance with the 5th criteria for the next year.
Great. Thanks. And I just wanted to clear that there were other options also.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2426 and open a work session for the chance to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. We're not going to work it further than that today. Do I have a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments?
So moved.
It's been moved by Representative Shields to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2426. Open a work session, a public hearing on House Bill 2427.
And House Bill 2427 creates a penalty for persons who refuse to submit to a blood or urine test as required by the implied consent law. We have both our fiscal and revenue statements on this, and it can be worked today.
Well, it can be worked today.
Yes.
Mr. Berger, Ms. Meyer again, please.
Members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Chair, did I do something wrong? We're getting to go first on bills that I'd always
excellent
like
amount
to hear more about from the proponents. This is a similar bill, I think, to the one that was heard earlier this session, and I had intended to join in on that. It's also similar to one that was heard 2 years ago, and we did testify in opposition. And I want to explain the reasons that we have concerns about this. I want to say at the get-go, ACLU has never said, nor do we believe, driving is a right. It is a privilege. But we have significant concerns when people lose some of the rights that they do have
when they get on the road as opposed to when they walk in the sidewalk, when they engage out in the public any other way than when they're in an automobile. And this whole scheme is requiring sort of implied consent when you are in a car. Again, I'm sympathetic to the issues around this, and I want to be very clear as to why we're raising concerns. What this bill does is, if I were to invoke and say, I do not want to give my blood, I do not want to give my urine, you need to get a court order, I'm invoking my right against this, against that kind of search without a court order, I'm penalized for doing that. I think we become very concerned when, in whatever situation, folks invoke their right to remain silent, to not be searched without probable cause or a court order. When they do that, they can be held, warrants can be obtained, but they shouldn't be fined for doing that. And especially when we get to a blood draw and a urine test, which do give more information about a person than simply their alcohol. I understand the blood draw may not be used for any other purpose, and hopefully we do protect it. As I've testified on other issues, blood, biological evidence, provides a great deal of information about a person. So people may have reasons, and I think they should get the court order. The officer at the hospital, whatever, should I believe there are telephonic and other ways to get the authority to do it, and they should do that, absolutely. But again, just invoking my right to refuse to give my blood, I just don't think we need to add a financial penalty. And I know, Chair Barker, you feel very passionately about this issue in terms of folks who are on the other side, and this does not detract from that. My testimony is not intended to detract from that. It is just a matter of concerns about our power to invoke our rights and what the penalty should be.
Ms. Farr, I just would suggest that you need to change the implied consent, because if you're walking down the street, I can't do that. This says, and people agree to that when they drive in Oregon. So.
Chair Barker, it's been a slippery slope, and we've opposed it, and then it was just so a number of years ago, it was for breath if you refused, there was a penalty, and now it's we're couching up on the rest of it. And my experience on things is we see exceptions to rules, and then the exception swallows the whole. ACLU doesn't like the implied consent, and if you stop me and you don't have probable cause, and I say, no, you can't search my car, you have to get a court order.
Thank you. Mr. Berger.
Representative Chair Barker and members of the committee, I didn't want to mislead you earlier. I have, in the last 6 months, tried two cannabis DUI cases, and I've represented one in Multnomah County and one in Baker County, and I've represented, on DUIs in Linn County and also in Polk County in the last year. So I do have some familiarity, especially with this stage of the proceeding. My recollection is that either refusing a breath test or refusing a urine test results in a suspension, but I don't recall there being a suspension incidental to refusing a blood test, unless I'm certainly willing to be mistaken about that. But I haven't handled cases involving blood tests, but what my friends who have tell me that the reason this shouldn't be added is that most of these refusals occur in emergency rooms where the person is in a poor condition to be making these kinds of important decisions. And in virtually every case, the hospital has already done a blood draw where there is blood available to the prosecution for its investigation of the case. So it's just not necessary to expand it to include blood tests, seems to be the concern primarily of the OCDLA members who handle these kinds of cases. We, of course, agree with ACLU that conceptually it's problematic that there's this by consent that the exercise of a right results in a penalty. But our primary concern, I think, is about the provisions about the blood test, again, because it's not necessary for the prosecution, and it's in a hospital setting. what happens is, at least in the cases I've seen, is the driver is stopped for whatever reason. The officer develops a reasonable suspicion. The driver may be under the influence of some kind of intoxicant. They are asked to perform field sobriety tests, depending on how they do on the tests, and if the officer thinks a chemical is involved, the officer will call in a person that's called a drug recognition expert, who performs, oddly enough, 12 steps to be able to determine whether the person is under the influence of one of seven groups of controlled substances. The seventh group is cannabis. And then based on that, part of that protocol is requesting either a urine test or a breath test. But I don't think it includes a blood test. I think a blood test really only comes up where the driver finds him or herself in the hospital, has already had blood drawn, and there's a subsequent request for blood testing. I'm certainly willing to be wrong about that, but if that's the only time that comes up, it seems different than the refusal to take a breath test or a urine test and ought to be treated differently by this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so it's four up and three up.
Three.
Okay, Mrs. Pratt, Mr. Ely, and Mr. Harkleroth. And please go in any order. Just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name's Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'll make this very short. House Bill 2427 is the same bill that you passed on February 29th. House Bill 2239, calling for a fine of $500 to $1,000 for refusal of blood and urine. Both are about responsibility, accountability, getting to the truth, identifying and removing the high-risk repeat DUI offender from our roadways, except that House Bill 2427 has a provision that directs a portion of the fund to the Oregon State Police Intoxicated Driver Fund. It helps to pay for the testing of blood and urine samples and the maintenance of breathalyzers, an area that is much in need of funds. The OSP forensic laboratory system processes the evidence to solve crimes and keeps our communities safe and more livable. Oregon State Police is responsible for the testing of blood, breath, and urine for most all law enforcement in our state. House Bill 2427 would also be consistent with the fine for refusal that we passed, refusal of the breathalyzer that we passed back in 2003. House Bill 2427 supports good public safety. I support House Bill 2427, excuse me, as does Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Crime Victims United, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. We'll just have everybody go ahead, and then we'll have questions on the panel, sir.
Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Ely, last name is Iwai. I'm employed with the Oregon State Police as a senior trooper, and I'm currently in charge of the drug evaluation classification program and the state coordinator position, which means that I run the DRE program for the state. I'm here today to summarize House Bill 2427. Basically, in cooperation with the motion by consent law, it punishes a person for refusing a blood or urine test with a fine between $500 and $1,000. Moreover, this amendment provides the same penalties as refusing the breath test and remains a violation, not a crime. Currently, ORS 813095, refusing the breath test, it does not include blood and urine. Furthermore, monies will be distributed and used by the state police for enforcing laws concerning DUII, whether or not the citation resulted was necessarily issued by the Oregon State Police. In 2007, the Oregon State Police arrested 3,706 impaired drivers, while 462 refused a breath test. The preliminary data for 2008 shows that the Oregon State Police arrested 3,620 impaired drivers, while 411 refused a breath test. Now, considering all police agencies in 2007, there were 3,620 breath test refusals, 201 urine refusals, and 117 blood refusals. For 2008, there were 3,489 breath refusals, 148 urine refusals, and 98 blood refusals. Oregon Drug Recognition Experts, or what you may have heard as a DRE, we performed 1,247 drug evaluations where 51 persons failed to submit to a urine test, which failed to corroborate the opinion of the evaluator in 2007. Similarly, for 2008, the Oregon Drug Recognition Experts performed 986 drug evaluations where 27 refused to provide urine. Again, by not providing the urine, it fails to corroborate the opinion of the DRE. And when the DRE is brought in for the case, obviously we're talking about a more convoluted and a more difficult case involves DUI. Although there are license sanctions right now that are available through the motion by consent law for refusing breath, blood, or urine, there is not a fine that an officer can issue to a suspect if they refuse to provide that. House Bill 2427 puts all biological specimens specific to driving while under the influence together. Currently, costs and half of the fines collected in circuit court are now credited to the state's criminal fines and assessment, or CFAA, account, which does not go to OSP. However, when OSP issues the citation for refusing the breath test, the remaining monies are directed to the state police and used for the OSP forensics. Last year, we received $52,394. This bill will redirect where that money goes. With the implementation of this bill, OSP, as the arresting agency, costs and half the fines collected in circuit court would go directly to the OSP intoxicated driver account. If the violation was processed through a municipality or a city, then it would go to the city. Half of that money would go to the city. And to a justice court, half to the county. The remaining balance is then subject to division in accordance with state law. And keeping in mind, we get what is left. If the court imposes additional fines because of this action and they're indigent and are unable to pay, then we just don't get that money. That's why we're at that $52,000 when that should be well over $200,000. This law is applicable to all city, county, and state police. A revenue increase is expected to the intoxicated driver account. However, that amount is indeterminate. Mr. Chair Barker, members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Harkleroad.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Doug Harkleroad, representing the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance on this bill and also the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are in support of House Bill 2427. I shan't repeat all of the good things that the two people to my right have said. However, this is a catch-up bill. It's a catch-up bill. What's it catching up to? It's catching up to science. The science has been around for blood testing, urine testing, and breath testing for a long time, and we've gotten better and better at it over time. And this law now lets us, if passed by this committee and the legislature, lets us catch up and use the science in an effective manner to deal with people who are under the influence when they're out there driving on the highway. And all this really does is it says we're going to add the science to the breath test that we now have, and the fine stays the same, it's $500 or $1,000 if you refuse. And just a note, the police officer doesn't just get to stop somebody for a speeding ticket, have no indication at all that they're under the influence, and say, oh, I want to take your breath, your blood, or your urine, and that's not valid. They've got to have probable cause to do this. There is a stopgap in there. They don't get to just do this. They have to have probable cause before they can move forward with that request. And if there is no probable cause, then there is not going to be a fine in $500 or $1,000 here. Thank you.
Thank you. Trooper Eri, I would just like to ask you, Mr. Berger was saying that the only time he could think of where that blood would be used would be a blood draw at the hospital. And I just was running through my head, the only I thought of possibly somebody with bad asthma or something like that couldn't really give an alveolar sample of their breath. But what other circumstances would it be where somebody would be asked for a blood draw?
Mr. Chair Barker, the attorney was correct in saying that it has to be a motor vehicle collision. there are certain parameters that we have to use. Most DUIs go through the breath test. Now, when they're at a medical facility and they're receiving medical treatment, we don't want to impose on that treatment that they're receiving. That's when we will use the implied consent, read them Section 1, A through H, and then request the blood. We will observe the phlebotomist or the emergency room technician take the blood from the subject after they obviously have consented to giving it. When we're working inside of implied consent, and I want to be very specific, there's a difference of working with implied consent or if you're just doing a voluntary urine, voluntary blood, or a voluntary breath test. But specifically for the blood, it's going to be involved in an incapacitating manner where the person's been involved in a motor vehicle crash.
Further questions? Representative
Stigler. Mr. Harkleroder, I probably should have asked you this before, but we're still on these DUI ones. When you were the district attorney in Lane County, and I probably a very rough estimate here, what proportion of your caseload was DUI?
About over time, on average, 5,000 cases a year. And depending on the staffing, frankly, of the police departments over time, 800 to 1,200 of them would be DUI cases. Pretty big.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, offline now is a fine time, but offline after the hearing is fine also. Related to the question I asked previous testifiers on what we know about what's happening in other states, if we had data not only on what other states are doing, but also what sort of results they're getting, you know, or have we seen, for instance, an increase in DUI penalties lead to what we all want, which is a decrease in either drunk driving or drunk driving deaths or anything else? Information like that would be really valuable. If you have it now, it's great. If you have it later, it's great, too.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, we made a note earlier to get you a memorandum on that.
Thanks very much. My reputation precedes me. For good or for ill.
Thank you. Now, we don't have a fiscal on this, or we do, I'm sorry, we do have the fiscal on this, and this bill can be worked today. No amendments are needed. I would accept a motion to move House Bill 20. Close the public hearing, open a work session.
We're getting there.
I would accept a motion to move House Bill 2427 to the floor with the due pass.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2427 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2427
to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Is there anybody who would like to carry that bill on the floor?
Representative Barton.
Would you like to carry that on the floor?
Of course, Mr. Chair.
We'll carry that.
Mr. Chair, as long as I have your attention, of course, Representative Garrett is excused. It's well known. He gets very prickly about implied consent law. I happen to know from discussions. FYI.
Okay. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2428. And this will not be moving. We will not be moving this today. It does have a fiscal. We're taking another look at that.
House Bill 2428 elevates assault in the third degree to a Class B felony if the offense was committed with a motor vehicle while the defendant was DUI.
Mr. Sparks, Trooper Iwai, and Mr. Hollenrod, please. Sorry about those names. Okay. who are we missing? This is Marie Armstrong. She's not in. While we begin with you, Trooper, if you'll identify yourself, please, and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael E.Y. Last name is I.W.A.I.
Thank you.
House Bill 2428, in summary, it will amend ORS 163-165, assault in the third degree, an increased penalty if the defendant commits assault by means of a motor vehicle and was driving while under the influence of intoxicants. Currently, ORS 163-165 does not include motor vehicle as a means. And back up, my name is Mike Ewy. I've been employed for state police for over 13 years, and I'm currently the Drug Evaluation and Classification Program Manager. In 2005, 647 drivers were involved in a motor vehicle crash where the driver had a BAC, or blood alcohol concentration, between 0.01 to 0.14%. Of the 647 drivers, 414 had BACs at or above a 0.15. In 2006, 895 drivers were involved in a motor vehicle crashes where the driver had a BAC between 0.01 to 0.14%. Of the 895 drivers, 571 had a BAC at or above a 0.15%. Lastly, in 2007, 97 drivers were involved in a motor vehicle crash where the driver had a BAC between 0.01 to 0.014%. Of the 971, 580 had a BAC at or above a 0.15. This does not count the subjects who refused blood draws, submitted to a chemical test where the breath test or where the tests were unknown, and the samples that may have been contaminated. Data for 2008 is not yet complete. From 2005 to 2007, Oregon had 355 lives taken as a result of a DUI-related collision where alcohol was a contributing factor. This accounts for driver, pedestrian, and also cyclists. For 2005, there were 110, while 2006 saw an increase to 113. In 2007, there were 132 lives lost due to DUI crashes, which was a significant increase from 2005 and 2006. Also, in 2006, there were a total of 478 fatalities from motor vehicle collisions, and in 2007, there were a total of 455 fatalities. House Bill 2428 provides stiffer penalties for those who drive a motor vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants and crash into other Oregonians or our visitors. Chair Barker and member of the committee, that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, we'd be more than happy to answer those.
Is there any questions to the trooper? Thank you. If Ms. Pratt, could you come up to it, either just pull an extra chair if somebody help her get a chair up there. Thank you. And is up there now? Yes, sir. Mr. Sparks, you want to go next, please?
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Chuck Sparks. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I've been with the Multnomah County DA's office for 23 years, and I supervise the unit that prosecutes all felony assaults involving vehicles and drunk drivers and homicides involving vehicles and drunk drivers. We have six lawyers in our unit, including myself, and it's our practice to go out to the scenes of these fatal crashes and serious injury crashes, which will be the subject of House Bill 2428. The Chair Barker, the principal concern, we have three concerns that I would like to address on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, which supports this bill. The principal concern is that many of these crashes involve an assault in the second degree. That's a Measure 11 offense because they involve serious physical injury with a dangerous weapon, an automobile, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. At times, the issue of recklessly and under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life or the question of serious physical injury can be litigated, can be justly argued about. And as a result, the District Attorney's Office at times considers plea negotiations, which will take the case out of Measure 11. The problem with having Assault 3 as a C felony instead of a B felony is this. We then go from the Measure 11 presumptive sentence of 70 months down to a maximum of 60 months that we can achieve, and that includes, that 60 months includes the time that the person will be supervised post-prison. So as you can imagine, people who commit these types of crimes benefit from supervision post-prison if they have a prison sentence at all. This bill, of course, would not necessarily require a prison sentence, but it gives us some place to go rather than taking a 70-month presumptive sentence and reducing it to such a degree that we have really a choice. Either very little pen time if we want to have adequate supervision, or not much pen time at all, if any, incarceration that's significant if we want to have significant supervision. So it's a trade-off. We have to typically then struggle to come out of Measure 11. It makes it a lot more difficult. It doesn't give us a place to go legally and still get adequate supervision for that person, or be able to have a sufficient amount of penitentiary time, although less than the 70 months. These cases, I want to emphasize, involve often people who are very seriously injured, and yet an offender might have no prior criminal history, might actually have a fairly long life with no prior criminal history. It might be somebody well on in their my age, 52 years old, who has no prior criminal history, and yet they would be looking at a 70-month Measure 11 sentence, or potentially a sentence with minimal supervision if there's going to be still a meaningful penitentiary sentence. Because the amount of injury that happens, the destruction that we see in the lives of the people who are victimized is extraordinary. And I can give you examples. I'm sure you can imagine them, and I'll provide them certainly if you have questions in follow-up. I have some examples I'd be certainly prepared to discuss. So that's one concern. We have it backs us into a corner and doesn't give us a good legal option that will give us enough time to supervise an offender after they've done a decent amount, a significant amount of prison. Second, there is a huge differential between assault in the second degree with the presumptive 70-month sentence and assault in the third degree, which has a presumptive sentence if a person has, I'm assuming the committee is all familiar with the sentencing guidelines grid, if the person is in the four least serious categories under the sentencing guidelines grid, which allows them to have up to three non-person felony convictions, that person will receive a presumptive sentence of 90 days if they're convicted of assault three, as opposed to a presumptive sentence of 70 months if they're convicted of assault in the second degree. That encourages people, frankly, to gamble and go to trial when perhaps that if it were not so quite so enticing, if there were literally nothing there as a sanction, they might think a little harder about putting the victims and their families through this. The third concern is tied into the second, and that is, what is a fair penalty? And when you look at what happens, when you look at the devastation that's worked when serious physical injury is inflicted, there really is no question that the 90-day sentence, which, by the way, would be eligible for a 20% good time reduction, so it's really 72 days, is not adequate when you look at the terrible devastation. And I'll just take one very quick anecdote. A young man who was the owner of his own business, he and his wife were planning a family, 31 years old, hit and almost killed and completely devastated by a drunk driver who left him at the scene, and ultimately had a blood alcohol level 4 hours later of a 0.12. And this young man, the victim in this case, is basically going to be dealing with life on the terms of a second grader. That's really his level of function. And to have this potentially have been available to the defendant in that case as an assault three with a presumptive sentence of 72 days is wrong. So in the final analysis, the District Attorney's Office of Multnomah County urges you to pass this bill to make the measures more, make the assault two and the assault three sanctions at least a little closer to each other. And I would point out that a judge would have the authority to provide or to impose no prison at all, because it would be the optional probation grids, the GH&I grids on level 8 would provide an opportunity for a court under circumstances that judges see where a judge would see fit to impose no sentence or to provide a rather minimal penitentiary sentence, but at least something that's significant compared to the presumptive of 72 days. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pratt.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Pratt, and again, I represent Governor's Advisory Committee, Crime Victims United, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And thank you very much for this opportunity. House Bill 2428 that requires Assault 3 to be upgraded from a 6 to an 8 on the sentencing grid if committed while driving under the influence of intoxicants, it is a good bill because the punishment needs to fit the crime. And under current law, the sentence of 90 to 180 days down to just probation, House Bill 2428 would more appropriately sentence this offender to 16 to 18 months. But again, as Mr. Sparks stated, leaves room for judicial discretion in rare cases where probation is appropriate. It also raises the crime seriousness level from a Class C felony to a Class B felony, which allows for the necessary 3 years probation for this very serious crime. It also follows suit with the bill we passed in 03 session, elevating the related crime of criminally negligent homicide if under the influence of intoxicants from an 8 to a 9 on the sentencing grid. DUI assault is a known risk, just as DUI homicide is a known risk, and they're both 100% preventable. These criminals knew or should have known the dangers, and after 28 years of Mothers Against Drunk Driving educating us on the risks of driving while intoxicated, there was no one who does not know it can seriously injure or kill someone, even innocent victims, particularly innocent victims. It is also a planned action that involves decisions, and it's go out, get drunk or drugged, drive home. It's not an accident. It's a crime that ruins lives. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration estimates the average cost for an injured victim who survives to be $108,000. But as you read the story of Sarah Edwards, you will realize the cost of Assault 3 and serious physical injury very greatly sometimes and oftentimes exceeds $108,000, not to mention the emotional costs, which are astronomical. You have written testimony from Sarah and also Bonnie Edwards, Sarah's mother. In a moment, you will hear from Marie Armstrong, whose son Chance was also killed in the crash. If we are ever going to make a difference in society's view of driving under intoxicants and the 200-plus injuries, we need to separate and draw attention to it and make the consequences more severe. House Bill 2428 not only then will make the punishment fit the crime, but will also create a societal deterrent effect. CVU and MAD and Crime Victims United all support House Bill 2428, and we urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Armstrong, please.
Chair Barker and committee members, many of you know my story, but for the few that do not, as you heard, my 20-year-old son, Chance Creed Hoff, was killed by a drinking driver on March 8, 1996. It has been a hard road for myself and for Sarah Edwards. Many of you will remember Sarah Edwards testifying in 2007. I will now tell you about my hero. Sarah Edwards was a vibrant 19-year-old straight-A student who aspired to become a veterinarian. When on March 8, 1996, her life changed forever. The car she was driving was struck by two vehicles driving by drinking drivers who were racing at excess of speeds of 90 miles an hour. Sarah's boyfriend, Chance Friedhoff, age 20, was killed by almost instantly when the passenger side of her car was crushed on a head-on collision by a vehicle driven by Timothy Hendrick and then struck on the driver's side by the vehicle that he was racing. Sarah actually was pronounced dead at the scene. Heroic efforts were made to save Sarah's life. Twice Sarah's heart stopped, once at the scene and one at the hospital. Doctors were able to save Sarah, but she would never again be the same person. The bright, young woman with plans for her life. Sarah Edwards sustained severe brainstem and internal injuries and remained in the hospital for 3 months, then was moved to a nursing facility for another 6 months. When Sarah came home for the first time, her mother, Bonnie, asked me to come over because we had to tell Sarah the chance was gone. She had thought that all of this time he was in another hospital going through the same medical adjustments she was. Sarah remained severely disabled. She lost the ability to control or use her right arm, drags her right foot, is unable to speak without slurring, and has little or no short-term memory. Sarah cannot remember the crash, most of her previous life, and current events. She also suffers from the result of massive injuries. The prognosis is unknown, but doctors and therapists agree that Sarah has most likely progressed as far as she ever will. For Sarah and her family, the monetary expense has been enormous. Health insurance for family ran out long ago. Sarah is on Medicare and state disability. The state purchased the home for Sarah that she is learning to live in by herself, which sits 100 yards from her parents' home. The expenses for one person's irresponsibility has cost around $2.5 million and will continue to cost the state for the rest of her life. Sarah Edwards will never be a veterinarian. She will never be able to work at all. She will never drive a car, go hike in the woods, go to college, or even care for herself. Sarah will continue to require constant medical care and depend on her mother and father to provide that, just as she has done for the past 13 years. Most of Sarah's friends have moved on and have successful careers, but Sarah will never be able to even leave home. Today, Sarah is 33, expresses anger at the death of Chance Friedhoff, the destruction of her life, and the inappropriately lenient sentence Timothy Hendrick received. Hendrick was sentenced to 90 days in jail for criminally negligent homicide, and 90 days for assault 3, which he got out for good time, for serious physical injuries, which ran concurrently. Life has gone on for Timothy Hendrick and the other drinking driver, but not for Sarah, and it never will. The slap on the wrist Hendrick, 19 at the time, received in 96 for his crimes made no difference in his criminal behavior. Hendrick continued to drink and drive and was involved in another serious crash in September of 96, hit a parked car in 99, and was arrested for DUI and driving while suspended while out on bail. Then served 18 months in prison. In 2002, Hendricks violated federal gun laws and has served his sentence of 46 months in federal prison. He was released on December 19, 2008, and will be able to continue his life. Please think about your own families, and what would you like the sentence to be? This time, please do not think of the fiscal, but the seriously injured that look to you for justice. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Armstrong. Again, we really appreciate it, and we have the written testimony, as you said, from Sarah and her mom, and those of us that were here in 2007 remember that like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. It was very moving testimony, and I appreciate you when you once again mentioned the fiscal. We always are talking about a different fiscal, but those are huge that your family has suffered, not only the financial fiscal but the emotional, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come down here.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Berger? I'm jumping ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Everybody has testified or not?
No, the trooper did not.
Trooper, please. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I already testified.
Oh, you did. Okay.
You did.
Right. I'm done. Just leading me. Okay. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Berger.
Chair Barker, Chair and members of the committee. When we inquired of our members who more regularly do this kind of work, we were unclear on what the impetus for this change in the law was. And the kinds of negotiations that go on in cases where Measure 11 is involved, as Mr. Sparks testified to, are a unique subset of the sausage making that occurs in criminal litigation. In Multnomah County, for example, there is a committee that evaluates offers, and typically a deputy district attorney needs the approval of the committee to be able to extend a particular offer. So as to that concern, the concern, you know, what if you've been charged with a assault in the second degree and there isn't anything to meaningfully negotiate for because assault in the third degree is a level six offense, I'm not really prepared to speak to that, and I would like the opportunity to speak with our membership and with the lawyers who handle these cases more regularly, because I think that part of the proposal is less problematic. I'm guessing that may be less problematic for them than the other aspects of it. I know, and Mr. Sparks and I spoke briefly before the hearing about how it's often the case that the person who is assaulted by the dangerous weapon is a friend or a relative who's in the passenger seat. And it creates putting the behavior in a situation where prison is, by making it a level 8 offense, unless you're in the GH or I category where optional probation is available if you weren't on supervision at the time, there's no gun involved, and treatment would better serve the offender in the community than incarceration, the judge would have to find substantial compelling reasons to depart to probation. And in many cases, this could result in the breadwinner being separated from the family and the ripple effects from that would be imposed. Where, and again, I'm talking about a situation where a person is driving, their friend or spouse or whatever is injured in a way that qualifies as serious physical injury, but isn't as serious as that term might otherwise sound. And we have that concern. Elevating it from a Class C felony to a Class B felony, which is not necessary to elevate it from level 6 to level 8, I don't think. I think it could remain as a C felony. Works two collateral effects. One is it deprives the court from either at the beginning of the case or at the conclusion of the case, the conclusion of the supervision, from having the case being treated as a misdemeanor. The other thing it does is that it makes it a thing that can't be expunged. You can't have the arrest record or set aside or the conviction record sealed. And I don't know if that's an intended consequence, but I am respectfully suggesting that it's not appropriate in all cases where there's a conviction for assault in the third degree involving somebody operating a motor vehicle under the influence of intoxicants. And then I know that Mr. Sparks didn't want to mislead you, but his testimony about the current law, I think, was a little incomplete. As a level 6 offense, it's a presumptive 3-year probation with no more than 180 sanction units, of which no more than 90 can be days in jail. But if a judge found substantial and compelling reasons to depart, a judge could depart for up to 18 months And as he points out, because it's a C felony, there would be 36 months of post-prison supervision, which is the level of post-prison supervision that's involved in those kinds of cases. So I was a little confused about the adequacy. The post-prison supervision would be 3 years, you know, irrespective, but it would be limited to 18 months. I understand if you're starting out with a charge, you know, as is often the case, you know, the grand juries still meet in secret. They're not recorded. We have a bill in this session, again, asking you to record those. The fact is that these cases are often overcharged. The cases are charged as assaults in the second degree when they really are assaults in the third degree. And, you know, if the problem is what do you do when you're stuck with this 70-month sanction that's mandated by law, maybe, and you want to negotiate the case, which is what I understood Mr. Sparks to say, and the negotiation maximum would be 18-month departure sentence with 36 months of post-prison supervision, maybe the answer is to take a look at whether 70-month mandatory minimum is appropriate. Maybe it's time to see if there's a two-thirds majority in both houses that can resolve the systemic difficulties that have been occasioned by the people's mistake in enacting Measure 11. So that's all that I have to say about this. I'm certainly willing to answer any other questions that you have.
As far as the people's mistake with Measure 11, when they had a chance to correct that, they came back with 75% approval on that. So, and as far as the breadwinner being separated, my God, we're just talking about what about the innocent breadwinner that's driving home and gets killed by one of these people? That's a separation that doesn't come back after 18 months or 36 months or 70 months. And as far as people being overcharged, if they are convicted, especially if they're convicted by a jury, I would debate that they've been overcharged. I think that might be an adequate charging if they're convicted under those.
Well, I understood, Chair Barker, and I don't mean any disrespect to anybody, especially the victims of these crimes. I'm concerned about casting too large of a net. And I heard really for the first time from Mr. Sparks, one reason or impetus for this bill is the difficulty in negotiating these assault and second-degree cases. And I certainly would appreciate from the Chair and the Committee the opportunity to speak again with our membership about, you know, whether, for example, moving it to level 8 is the problem or creating the B felony is a problem, or could we live with one or the other. I didn't understand what the basis of the change was.
We're not going to attempt to move this out today, so you'd have the chance. Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you. And then
thank you,
Mr. Harkleroad.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I don't intend to repeat what the earlier panel said up here. I would like to tell you one thing, though, about the sentencing structure. And you heard that this drops all the way to 90 days from 70 months. 70 months is the assault in the second degree, which is the Measure 11 offense. If you go to currently to assault in the third degree, it's a probationary sentence of 3 years, maximum of 180 days of sanction units. That's community service, that's work camp stuff, that's not jail, and then 90 days jail. The one thing I want to tell you about this is I believe the one-third rule applies to that 90 days. And you say, what's the one-third rule under sentencing guidelines? The one-third rule says the judge can only use one-third of the 90 days the first time he sentences or she sentences that offender. So it's really 30 days under sentencing guidelines. And if the probation is revoked subsequently, they can use the next 60 days. So it's even lower, I believe, than what you were told by the first panel. The point here, and oh, by the way, I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance and also the Oregon District Attorneys Association in my testimony here. We need a spot somewhere in between, which Mr. Sparks eloquently told you about, and I don't need to repeat that, to take cases that shouldn't go for 70 months. That's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Harper? Thank you, Mr. Harper. Is there any further discussion? Representative Krieger.
I've heard this DUII debate now for, 8 years, you and I have, something like that. I've got 17 grandchildren, of which 11
are between 11 and 22 years of age, and we keep praying we're going to be able to move them through this process to adulthood and responsibility in one piece. And you hear these stories, it just makes you really wonder. Someone's got to be accountable, and maybe it is the example others see that will keep somebody from having a life like we've heard.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Harper.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2428, and I have two more bills, committee bills, to be adopted, two LCs to be adopted. One of them is relating to individuals with disability, relating to products of individuals with disabilities. The other is relating to unlawful possession of a firearm. By adopting these, it does not mean you support or don't support the bills. And the major first one is LC 2826.
Chair, I move LC 2826 be submitted as a committee bill.
Representative Wisnett moves LC 2826 be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill is LC 2982.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2982 be adopted as a committee bill.
Representative Wisnett moves LC 2982 be adopted as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Any further business come before the committee today? Meeting adjourned.